welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. Michael Hansen. The Mind Web story for this half hour is The Tank and Its Wife, a story by Arson Darnay. The tank drove around the mansion's curving drive, passing between lavish flower beds. It was a small tank, painted in random green, beige, yellow patches, a vehicle perfect for the quick and darting guerrilla warfare of the African plains. But this wasn't Africa. The pretentious mansion, a mixture of temple and hacienda, topped a California hill. It was enthroned in a near-empty landscape, far from affluent neighbors spotted on other hills. The sun lay bright on rolling lawns. Sprinklers spurted brilliantly. There would surely be a pool in the back, turquoise in the sun, and stables down the hill, and a gardener who rode a wheeled fortress with automatic transmission to mow the placid acres of green. The tank made a fearful noise. It had no muffler, and the rapid blah, blah, blah explosions of its engine drowned out the clattering, chainy, metallic clicking of its tracks. Long before the muzzle of its gun had come into view over the steep approach, the lady of the house, attracted by the racket, had run to a bay window to peer out through gauze curtains. She stood there still, mesmerized and puzzled, when the tank suddenly wheeled at the apex of the drive and, with treads churning newly planted bulbs and dark, moist dirt on either side of the entrance apron, it crashed with a deafening roar and a turmoil of splintering, cracking, tearing, and crunching noises through the portals into the foyer and then into the spacious living room. The tank seemed to pause. Then its turret swung from left to right, swept a chandelier against the ceiling, pulverizing it in the process, and at last it faced the lady of the house. She screamed, unheard, and stood now pressed hard against the window, her hands half covering her face, her eyes frozen in terror. A panel opened in the turret. A black barrel looked out, then briefly rattled. A string of bullets tore into a wall, demolishing two glass-framed watercolors showing Parisian scenes. The pattern of the bullet spelled a message. "I," it said. The woman ran out sobbing and frantic, stumbling over the dusty rubble and chewed-up carpeting behind the tank. She ran down a hallway, floored in colorful terrazzo, through a paneled room with antlers and bookshelves, through a spacious, glittering kitchen, bright with copper pots hung from wooden pegs, and out to a glass-roofed patio. She raced on from there, past the swimming pool, down the deep lawn, toward the stables. She screamed, "Herman! Herman!" But the gardener was nowhere to be seen, and she began to sob at her own ineffectualness. The tank came behind her. She heard it roar and glimpsed over her shoulder the white dust it caused to boil out of the house. The tank emerged through an opening wider by far than the sliding glass door it pushed before it, frame and all ground to dust under its tracks on the irregular gray slate of the patio. The tank stopped and appeared to survey the scene. Then its gun fired with a roar, causing the tank to rock back on its treads. Three shells arched over the diminishing form of the lady. They raised geysers of dirt into the air before her. Spent steel fell at her feet. Her ears buzzed with the explosions. She turned, unthinking, and saw the tank. It stood half covered by the wire-reinforced glass roof of the patio. A stream of fire spurted from an aperture in its turret and fell to the sloping grass beyond the pool. Black smoke boiled from the lawn, spent itself, and left a scorched pattern of words. "Darling, wait. I am home." The lady's face worked out of control. She had mascara around her raid, middle-aged eyes. Her lashes had been lengthened, her face carefully made up, her lips accentuated by a pale pearl lipstick. Now her usually cool, smooth features were those of a terrified child. She covered her face. collapsed slowly, assumed a fetal posture, and began to rock. The sergeant was hysterical, a state he frequently experienced. He appeared to be jumping up and down, quivering with impatience, while two kneeling soldiers in fatigues connected the grayed copper ends of a cable to an oblong box with instruments on its face. The cable hung in a loose spiral from a frame just beneath the blinding, neon-lighted, corrugated roof of the hangar.
Come on, come on, what does it say?
The men were busy and said nothing. The sergeant wrung his pudgy hands. He sucked air between his clenched teeth and looked entreatingly up at the roof as if to invoke the Almighty's aid. One of the soldiers turned his head.
The line's dead and no stimulation coming through at all. Are you sure?
The sergeant turned abruptly and ran between two rows of tanks. He was a pear-shaped man, unaccustomed to running. His fattish rears danced back and forth. His ankles turned inward. His eyes swept the tanks as he ran, each camouflage colored and linked by coiling cable to the central stimulator mounted under the roof. The tanks looked peaceful and harmless in the huge, echoing hangar. 99 identical tanks in four rows. Only one was missing, T-98, midway in the third row. The sergeant ran toward a half-open door through which could be seen part of a coffee urn set on a typewriter table, and next to it, white cups that bore the colorful heraldic emblem of the PFP command. He stopped at the door and looked with still fresh horror at a monstrous jagged hole in the hangar's metal wall through which T-98 had made its exit during the night. And he looked beyond the gash, across a tread-marked expanse of gravel at the ruination of the chain-link fence. It resembled a basketball basket laid on its side.
Yeah, sweet Jesus,
the sergeant muttered, and then ran on, imagining the track of rubble, twisted metal, fleeing civilians and burning houses that T-98 could well have left behind. He arrived at his office panting, and reached across his desk for the telephone speaker laid on a heavily doodled calendar blotter. Captain Richards had been holding. The sergeant told him what the instruments had said. Captain Richards called Colonel Baxter. Baxter called General Hals. And General Hals went to a sleek blue and cream computer console against the window of his office and typed T-98 on the keyboard. The machine began to clatter almost instantly. Hals first skimmed a brief precis of the long report.
Subject John Hamilton. Entered PFP program 6985, age 56, after stroke paralysis. Background, career, real estate. Well-to-do, no children or surviving siblings. Politically, right of center. Application filed by wife. Radio ad response. Who described subject, living vegetable, better dead than alive. An executed battery of release forms, subject dead. Wife was told, oral and written, probability subject survival was 2.9%. Was notified 12-286, subject succumbed to complications, nervous system transplant operation. Funeral held using actual body, later displayed wake for friends and associates. Subject enrolled Tank Corps 12-19-86. Performance undistinguished. Scheduled African Theater 5-5-87.
General Hals began to read the meat around his skeleton, but he didn't get very far. Reports began pouring in, and he knew he had a crisis on his hands. He ordered his helicopter to be brought around, armed himself with a lacquered swagger stick on whose end a gilded bullet gleamed, and took off to supervise the capture operation from the air. By the time the general arrived above the scene, hovering in the sun in his bright sphere, the chopper blades a smoky halo above the bubble, the hilltop mansion was under siege. Military forces, sheriff's deputies, two fire companies, and the highway patrol were on the spot. A crowd of gawkers had also gathered, among them two reporters demanding to know who was in charge. General Hals told Captain Richards to stall the press a little, and this the captain undertook to do. He strode from his Jeep toward the pesky reporters with a stiff, forbidding curl about his lips, but he had flutters in his stomach. General Hal surveyed the scene and saw the errant T-98 midway down the eastern hill. It stood in the midst of a rutted, reddish area where its various maneuverings had stripped the thin sod from the clay. Its wife had to be that curled-up bundle on the ground. But the general assumed that she was still alive. T-98 attempted still to communicate with her in various ways. At uneven distances from the tank lay the smoking wreckage of jeeps, patrol cars, and a fire engine. Men occasionally peered from behind those feeble barriers. The general made a quick decision and called Richards once again.
Richards, is your jeep still working?
Positive on that, General.
All right, Richards, get the radio out of it and then send it down the hill toward the tank.
Roger on that, General.
Wait a minute. While the tank's busy with a jeep, I want the men down here below me to get in there and drag the woman away.
We may sustain casualties, General.
Then sustain them.
And the general thought about the members of the press and what those gentlemen would write about a tank that penned love letters on plush suburban lawns with a flamethrower. The evidence had to be eradicated at the first opportunity.
Darling, I have missed you more than I can say,
said a scorch mark just below the pool. Near the stable stood the words,
our years together are my most cherished memories.
Another telltale message below the patio said,
darling, wait, I am home.
And yet another, a little lower.
Why are you afraid of me? Why do you run from me?
The general put in a call for Air Force jets. He wanted napalm. The planes should assume a holding pattern nearby. He would do it, despite the bad publicity. He would wash this hill in fire. Better that way. Richards had done as ordered. The jeep appeared from the shadows of one of the mansion's wings and began a slow, throttled descent toward T-98. It was driverless, of course. The tank saw the jeep approach and swung its turret to take aim. At that moment, men hiding in the cover of the wreckage to T-98's rear rushed forward. The tank was still enjoying the lovely ball of fire it had made of Captain Richards' jeep, a face of fire with a blackish crown of smoke that rose and mushroomed almost as delightfully as a tactical nuke, when the men grabbed the lady of the house and ran away down the hill. The tank swiveled sharply and lowered its gun, but nothing happened. T-98 evidently did not wish to harm its spouse.
Sir? Sir? General?
The general saw the pilot pointing toward the distant hills at another helicopter. General Hal's was a cool, precise, unflappable man. He was entirely like the faultlessly shaped mustache he wore, whose every hair he inspected daily, and whose misdemeanors he corrected every morning, face close to the mirror with a golden fingernail clipper. He knew that the approaching helicopter was none other than WTUV's Eye in the Sky. Its cameras would be loaded for action. They would relish recording T-98's effusions on videotape. Despite the irritation Hal's felt in that moment, he showed none of it outwardly. He called the Air Force and ordered napalm dropped. The Air Force was sorry. The special code word the general had used in ordering the strike could not be found in any of the books. Higher headquarters had been consulted, but no response had been received. And under the circumstances, the target area was under the jurisdiction of the state of California. The governor had not... Well, by the time the Air Force had rogered out, WTUV's Eye in the Sky had come, had seen, and was still taping. It had much to record. The tank had been stung by its wife's abduction and displayed its rage in a barrage of artillery. Shells leveled the mansion. Machine gun bullets sprayed. Fire swept the lawn, obliterating, thank heaven, some of the tank's own words. And the tank darted this way and that, attacking everything in sight, save only the wreckage where its wife lay sheltered by soldiers, sheriffs, and firemen. The general decided it was time to put an end to it, and he told Richards to bring in bazookas. The tank spent itself in rage, but inwardly it felt the throat clutch of intense disappointment, impotence, and sadness. The bold adventure was over before it had begun, finished the dream. Could it have cried? The tank would have cried. The night before, parked in the hangar with its mates, the tank had expected another night of pornographic dreaming, much like every other night before, to be followed in the morning by training exercises to teach the tank how to use the still unfamiliar and strange prosthesis, which seemed so huge, clumsy, and lacking in proper means of communication. Such was the round of its life. But then, to its puzzlement and delight, the compelling sex bliss had stayed away. It had enjoyed the total stillness of utter leisure, and not just for a moment, but for hours on end, recalling suddenly that life had been like that before, in a wheelchair. But now the stillness and the leisure were a blessing rather than a curse. Toward morning had come the electrifying notion that it was no longer quite so helpless as in that wheelchair long ago. It had means of locomotion and of communication at its disposal. It tried the engine, and it started. It engaged a gear, and it took. Then the tank experienced a moment of emotion so strong and excruciating that it would have fainted had it been a body rather than just a packaged brain. It had a vision of its wife, that other being next to whom he had lived so many years, so thoughtlessly, taking her so for granted. And after the stroke, he had not been able to say to her what he had wanted to say more than ever, that he loved and appreciated her, that his life with her had been a quiet but joyous time, all he had wanted. But now, now it could undo all that. It could move and speak again, however clumsily. It could see her one last time before they shipped it out to Africa. So the tank had broken rank inside the hangar and had begun its long trip home. And now, now the dream was over. She had not recognized it, had fled from it, had hidden her eyes from its frantically spelled messages. Well, the tank would die here on its own turf. After its moment of freedom, it loathed the thought of training and nightly bliss. It wished to die. The bazooka teams arrived at last, and after some dangerous maneuvers, destroyed one of the tank's treads. With one track lamed and the other under power, the tank turned about its own center like a swirling maniac intent on digging a grave for itself in the gouged and bleeding earth. Then came a shell that fastened on the turret like a fire leech and ate its way into the metal, a fizzing, sparkling circle of voracious light and heat. Visual connections linking the tank to its eyelets and its turret melted into dripping ends of wire. And finally, the second tread was also shot away, and the tank was paralyzed. Outside its shell, sweating and anxious men prepared to carve holes into the metal, using laser guns linked by cables to a power pack mounted on a track. Up above, General Hal's bobbed and dipped and buzzed like a hungry mosquito scenting blood. WTUV's Eye in the Sky had landed. The cameraman was taking footage from the edge of a temporary barrier made of strung-out fire hose and guarded by deputies and a stalking, grim-lipped Captain Richards. The lady of the house babbled incoherently in a speeding ambulance. She lay on a stretcher covered by blankets. A young man in white squatted at her head. The driver of the ambulance had the radio on. He listened to a country crooner finishing a song. "Pamper me with praises, ply me with love," the woman sang. And then again on a concluding note, "Pamper me with praises, ply me with love." The song ended, and the announcer came on.
Now, folks, here's a public service message from the Department of Defense. The folks down Pentagon Way have come up with a new program for people with disabilities. They say it's kind of a dividend on all the tax dollars we spend on military research. The program is called Prostheses for Peace, meaning that the Defense Department will help people who can't see or hear or walk or such, and it's absolutely free. Mind now, those folks can't guarantee a thing, but if you've got someone near and dear you want to help, call now and they'll tell you how to file an application. What about it? Get off that old rocker, people, and do something for Gramps and Granny, hear? Now, that toll-free number again is...
Back at the mansion, the laser carvers had penetrated to the package. They snipped through its connections and brought it out through the seared, irregular oval cut in the tank's side. The package resembled a mid-sized picnic cooler. General Hals had already landed in anticipation of this event. Men loaded the package into his helicopter. Moments later, the copter rose and sped away, leaving Captain Richards to fend for himself against a swollen compliment of the press. The reporters clamored for explanations. Why had the driver come to this place? What did all those messages mean? Why didn't he get out of the tank? Was the driver the woman's husband? And was the driver still alive? What about the thing the copter had carried off? Classified records? Had the driver gone nuts? Berserk? What detachment was this, anyway? To all of this, Richards replied by repeating monotonously that an official statement would be made at a later time. He had no authority to... And then, inexplicably, to the observers, airplanes appeared on the horizon, flying low. They came in. Napalm drums fell, burst, and washed the hill with fire. Richards, reporters, sheriffs, firemen, soldiers, and gawkers barely escaped the Holocaust. The Air Force had found General Hal's code word at last and had hastened to obey his order. General Hal's, his exquisitely polished boots at rest on the package, communicated with the Pentagon by radio telephone. He set in motion a series of phone calls all over the nation. Men less cool than he went to work on senators and congressmen, a governor, and the president of a TV station. In a pinch, the general reflected, he could even blind WTUV's eye in the sky. The tank's inertial systems had survived the battle. It knew itself in motion and guessed that it had failed. It had been deprived of its death. It felt devastated, cheated, and sank into a catatonic numbness. The motion continued for a while. Then its character changed. The tank was being carried now by men into the hangar, probably, into that bright yet gloomy expanse that at this hour would be empty. Its buddies and comrades would be out on the range learning counterinsurgency. Then the motion stopped, and the tank felt it coming. An explosion of searing pleasure as electronic impulses of supreme delicacy began to stimulate selected neuron bundles in its brain. It copulated with 1,000 women all at once. It disappeared into transports of delight. The dream of that quiet night and the difficult adventure out there in the sunlight visiting its own past faded into an insignificant, pale, underexposed episode, the disintegrating spider webs of memory. You've heard The Tank and Its Wife, a story by Arsène Darnay, which first appeared in Analog magazine of January 1978. This is Michael Hansen. Technical production for this program by Rich Grody. MindWebs is a production of WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.